ISIS has reportedly damaged an archaeological site in northern Iraq using heavy machinery. That's according to Iraq's Ministry of Tourism and Antiquities, which posted a statement on its website Thursday and said ISIS bulldozed the ancient city of Nimrud.
Just south of Palmyra lie these ancient ruins that have survived for 2,000 years. But this UNESCO World Heritage site in Syria is now at risk of being destroyed by so-called Islamic State militants. As they entered the main city slightly
further... If ISIL were to destroy the classical ruins, the Roman ruins in Palmyra in Syria, this would equal some of the other atrocities they've committed against our civilization.
Armies, insurgents, and armed fanatics have been looting, destroying, and repurposing sites of archaeological and cultural significance for millennia. Sad, but true. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. So is what Islamic State is now doing in Iraq and Syria any different? Well, Deakin University's Benjamin Issakhan says it is. He says our cultural heritage is under threat like never before, increasingly vulnerable to the bulldozers and sledgehammers of the ideologically zealous. Priceless artefacts are being destroyed on an industrial scale, says Issakhan, and he's now building a global database to document the recent treasures destroyed in both Syria and Iraq. He's among our guests today on Future Tense as we look at archaeology and the artefact, current risks and future possibilities. We'll also hear from the Queensland Museum's Chantel Knowles, who explains why those who scour the past always have an eye firmly on the future.
Museums collect objects and research objects. That's what we do. And when you're collecting objects, you're thinking about the future. You're always thinking about the future, and you're trying to predict what will be meaningful to the generations that follow. And you're also working with the fragments of the past, thinking what's meaningful to people today. And it's really hard to know when an object will come to the front of the storehouse. And I say that as if an object can walk to the front of the storehouse. But objects do seem to have that agency which pushes themselves forward at different moments.
Chantel Knowles, and we'll hear more from her shortly. But let's go straight to Dr. Benjamin Issakhan and the deliberate targeting of sites of archaeological importance.
I often say that for about as long as we've been building culture and building cultural institutions and artistic relics and so on, we've been tearing them down, and that's absolutely true. You can go right back through the history of human civilization and you can find many examples of burning libraries or destroying churches or tearing down gods and relics of other civilizations. But in terms of the scale of what we're witnessing at the moment, particularly in the Middle East, it is completely unprecedented. It has no parallel in history. And that is simply because the people doing this kind of heritage destruction have access to technology that earlier empires and earlier iconoclasts and earlier people who would want to tear down the monuments of the past simply didn't have. They have modern military technology that enables them to do industrial-scale heritage destruction in a very short amount of time. So what would have taken years to destroy with shovels, for example, at an archaeological site, now takes days to destroy with bulldozers and heavy equipment and heavy machinery and so on. So really, this, I think, speaks volumes about the scale of what's happening and how serious it is and how much of it is going on.
It is important to remember, isn't it, that this is not just the destruction of Iraqi or Syrian culture. This is world culture, isn't it?
Absolutely. When we talk about Iraq and Syria, the term that we've often used is the cradle of civilization. What we mean by that is the cradle of the entire story of human civilization.
What are the future implications of the ISIS attacks that we're seeing on cultural heritage in the Middle East? I mean, would you expect, because of their example, that others in the future will follow, will start to see cultural sites increasingly as, political or ideological weapons?
Perhaps your listeners will remember way back in 2001, the earliest seeds of Al-Qaeda, at that time also enmeshed with the Taliban, destroyed what were known as the Bamiyan Buddhas in Afghanistan. And this made global headlines. And what fascinated the Taliban at the time and the earliest sort of incarnations of Al-Qaeda was that of all the terrible things that they had been doing, and they had been doing all kinds of atrocities in terms of quashing human rights and creating a very oppressive state and so on, of all the terrible things that they were doing, the thing that grabbed international global news headlines was their destruction of the Bamiyan Buddhas in Afghanistan. And I think that that served as a key lesson for them in terms of how to maximize the impact of the kind of message of terror that they're trying to send out to the world. You fast forward to a group like ISIS, who have learnt all of these lessons and realise that, you know, of all the things that they're doing, of all the horrific humanitarian tragedies that are unfolding on a day-to-day level under the Islamic State, the thing that is grabbing global attention are those moments in which they attack heritage sites. And so the future of this is really scary, because if ISIS are able to do this kind of mass heritage destruction today, and future generations are likely to learn from that and see the impact of that globally, then it seems very reasonable to conclude that later forthcoming iterations of groups like ISIS, these sort of very extremist fundamentalist groups, will continue that legacy and will take any opportunity to destroy anything that the world holds to be significant heritage.
The Artifact as a Weapon of Conflict and Ideology, Dr. Benjamin Isakhan, spelling out the scope of cultural destruction underway in the world today. As I mentioned earlier, Dr. Isakhan has been involved in a significant project to construct a database of all damaged or destroyed cultural sites in Iraq. He's just coming to the end of the first phase of that work, which has dealt with around 600 heritage sites in that country, damaged between 2003 and 2011. And he's just received additional funding to extend his database into the future and to encompass destruction also occurring in Syria. But he isn't just recording past offences. He's one of those calling for the international community to do more to prevent future destruction.
If we, the collective international community, decide that these important heritage sites across the Middle East are what we might consider seminal moments of human civilization and therefore ought to be protected, then, you know, we need to start having systems in place and a very coherent, organized plan about what we will do in situations where states begin to collapse or terrorist groups emerge or militias take over or, you know, it borders on a failed state. There are a whole heap of things we can do. We can move anything that's movable, so the contents of various museums like that in Mosul, like that at Palmyra, like that across much of the Middle East, many of those objects are movable, easily movable. And they could be, if we had international treaties in place, quite easily shipped out of the country or out of that part of the country on a temporary basis to a safe haven in a neighbouring state, or even perhaps here in Australia or to the UK or to the US, kept in appropriate museums under lock and key until such a time as that state returns to a position where it has enough stability and enough peace to be able to deal effectively and take back those items. In terms of the bigger sites, they are, of course, very difficult to protect. But once again, I mean, I think that there ought to be some kind of system in place where the UN coordinates activities that would help to protect and preserve these kind of important archaeological sites.
But the question is, of course, do the governments of the world have the will or even the interest to start developing such future-focused measures for the protection of antiquities? It's worth noting that Britain still hasn't ratified the 1954 Hague Convention for the protection of cultural property in the event of armed conflict. It's apparently been promising to do so for more than a decade. But there have been some positive signs. A few months ago, the United Nations passed a resolution obliging member states to improve their capacity to seize stolen antiquities that come from the territories controlled by Islamic State. And Dr. Issakhan also sees promise from a recent initiative in the Middle East itself.
One really positive development, I think, has been very recently 10 Middle Eastern states met in Cairo and created what's called the Cairo Declaration, in which they agreed to crack down in a very strict way on any looting or any smuggling of antiquities across their borders. And this is unprecedented. Because of corruption and because of various other issues, they have to some extent turned a blind eye to some smuggling and black market operatives who have been working across their borders and moving a lot of these antiquities out onto the international black market. If these Middle Eastern states have these agreements in place, they therefore would be in a position to be much harsher, to have much stricter laws about antiquity smuggling, and to enforce these transnationally, not just within one state. And I think that the international community, again, needs to work with the signatories to these kinds of agreements and to continue to reinforce that.
Benjamin Issakhan at Deakin University.
Welcome to the Museum of Stolen Art. The Museum of Stolen Art is a virtual space for pieces that went missing and cannot be viewed physically anywhere in the world.
The Museum of Stolen Art is a New York initiative which, like Benjamin Issakhan's database project, is also about documenting cultural treasures. It's a museum in which visitors are required to wear a virtual reality headset in order to see the art.
We are dedicated to being the foremost museum of stolen artworks in the world and also to assisting in their recovery. For looted art, go to your right. For art theft, go to your left. If you come across any of these pieces outside of the museum, please report immediately to the International Police.
The use of virtual reality technology, 3D printers, and high-definition photography is now becoming common in museums and galleries around the world. And these are also the tools increasingly employed by modern archaeologists. Professor Maurizio Forte is one of those at the cutting edge of change.
I have a new project at Duke University on lost heritage. So we are collecting data from sites which are destroyed now or they are in danger. And we teach the student how to reconstruct them from photos, from aerial photos, from satellite, from any kind of information we can collect from internet, from private institutions or public institutions. So I think this is one of the several potential and several challenges for 3D technologies. We can also go back to the past, for example, recovering old photos, and from them we can generate models. This, of course, is one of the several ways we approach digital heritage, not just archaeology, but in general digital heritage.
And what's also proving a boon to archaeologists is the way in which simulated digital spaces are enabling greater scientific cooperation.
It's based on the idea of a collaborative environment. So we can simulate a 3D space where we have different scholars, different students, different minds in action. So the why? Well, because, for example, in a simulated environment, we can have different experts and interacting with that context and so different data sets, databases, but they actually play in a different way because the performance is based on different skills. So the collaborative idea is the fact that because it's a multidisciplinary work, we need people with different background working together. This is something very difficult to do in the field because, it's very expensive and many times we don't have the right expert when a specific research question comes from a stratigraphy or comes from an artifact. So the collaborative idea is to have a virtual environment where we can have this kind of responses or interaction, and it can be open to many. In the future, we might have a virtual labs solving problems and answering questions in real time during the fieldwork, for example.
And when Professor Forte talks about digital tools enabling greater collaboration, he means it in a truly interdisciplinary sense. One of his interests at the moment is in pioneering an approach he calls neuroarchaeology, which involves building fully immersive digital environments around ancient artifacts and then collaborating with neuroscientists to see how modern human brains react to what they see and what they experience. The idea being to gain a greater insight into the minds of our ancestors.
We don't know what happens to the brain when we run to specific application or simulation. So there are some universal in the way we perceive, we collect information, in the way we generate feedback, body and mind feedback from the environment, which can be very similar to what was generated in the past. A lot of questions related with thinking in the past and perceiving the reality in the past, which are, of course, philosophical, aesthetic, and so on. And we hope that they can be revealed or at least studied more in detail through a different approach. That's why maybe one day neuroarchaeology could help.
Maurizio Forte, Professor of Classical Studies, Art, Art History, and Visual Studies at Duke University in the United States. This is Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell. Now, what Professor Forte's approach is really all about is moving us away from the notion that the physical artefact is all that's important in archaeology. It's not to downplay it, it's just to appreciate new opportunities for research. And the high-tech tools he uses are about creating non-physical aids to our understanding of history, aids like immersive environments or high-resolution digital replicas that help us to tell new stories and to interrogate them. Let me reintroduce you now to Chantelle Knowles from the Queensland Museum. Chantelle talks about every object, every artefact, having its moment, a moment that isn't always clear at the time of collection.
In a museum, we have the fragments of the past, but we're always collecting. Every day, new things come into the museum. And that's us thinking about the future, because we assess an object when it comes in. We think about the possibilities that it might have in the future. How will this become a fragment of the past? How will it remain meaningful to people 10, 50, 100 years from now? And we don't know when that meaning will be attributed, when that eye will alight on it and it will suddenly get its moment. We don't know if that's going to be in 5 years' time or 100 years' time.
So the greatest value for a particular object that a museum takes in may not be for decades.
And that's often about, you might collect the ephemera of an event, but actually no one else did. So suddenly that has value because everyone collected the official merchandise or the official document or the object that won the art prize, but they didn't collect, you know, the things that were being made around that art fair, the stuff that was being sold on the street. And so suddenly what you have is a rarity and value because it shows a different side to an event or a moment in time. And you don't ever know when that's going to rise to the surface for either a researcher or a community.
So you have to make calculated guesses about what's going to be important in the future or what might have significant value for your community in the future. But you're also going to have to be highly speculative, aren't you?
And we are highly speculative. And the way we bring rigor to that is we discuss what we're going to collect prior to it. If it's a collection about an event or from a particular community, we'll lay everything out on the table and interrogate each object, ask questions of each other. Why collect this? What's the meaning of this? How do we think it's going to be used? Oh, well, you know, some objects you can predict are going to live their lives front of house in an exhibition. They're aesthetically beautiful. They tell multiple stories. But other objects are going to be those quiet sleepers. But you can still speculate about their intrinsic value and how they're going to draw people in the future. And you do get good at it, but you also are very aware as a curator that you're going to make some errors of judgment. But that might be an error of judgment for 50 years, but in 200 years, it might be spot on.
And the Queensland Museum actually had an amazing stroke of luck, didn't it? In that sense, a piece of papyrus, a piece of Egyptian papyrus, turned out decades later after the acquisition to be quite a significant historical artefact, didn't it?
Yeah, and it has more to be discovered. So we know what's in our collections. We knew we had Egyptian papyrus, 100 fragments, We took one fragment out and put it on display. And we were collaborating with the British Museum, and their Egyptologist came over. And he looked at the fragment, and he looked again. And then he asked us if we had any more, and we have 100. And we have a fragment of a much larger Book of the Dead. And the Book of the Dead is held by British Museum, the Met in New York. And this was a missing fragment. So suddenly, we had another piece in the jigsaw puzzle of this one man's story that was kept with him in his, when he was entombed in Egypt. So now we know who it relates to. We know the other collections it relates to. But have we pieced those fragments back together yet? No. So it's going to get another moment. And whether that's in 5 or 25 years, we don't know. But it will get another moment when we actually are starting to be able to put the fragments together, read the document, and then a whole new story unfolds.
So you're collecting for the future, but you're also looking at what you've already got, haven't you? Mm-hmm. And you're looking for narratives around that. So how do you do that? How do you open up, in a sense, your collection to allow for the greatest amount of interpretation?
So we have many researchers with very specific interests that come behind the scenes at the museum. But we also open our doors to community members and to interested people, because these are the community's collections. It's all of our past, and it's held by the institution on everyone's behalf. The beauty of the future is that, you know, we're now moving into a digital world where potentially you could scan these objects, you can make 3D copies of them through 3D printing, and you start to see things then that perhaps you don't see with the naked eye under light. I don't think you can ever take away from the original. There's something about it, it's imbued with the hands that have touched it, but you can make amazing replicas now. I mean, the Mona Lisa now also sits, an accurate facsimile, sits in the house where it would have sat when it was first painted. And it's accurate to brushstroke detail, but it's still not what everyone queues up in the Louvre to see. And so it's a tension in museums. We want to preserve the artefact. We want to promote access. We know that the artefact itself engages people, and the facsimile may never actually do that to the same extent, but by making a facsimile, it makes you think differently about the object. You start to see things that perhaps you didn't see when you were weighing it up in your hands in the stores. You know, you start to see tool marks that are really difficult to see in the naked eye, but when it's a scanned, 3D scan, you suddenly see the depth of the work, and you can see the abrasions, and these can be replicated. So the museum is now tussling between the value of the real object and its preservation and what can the artificial reality of an object give you, whether it's online and you can spin the object round and see it, or whether it's holding a facsimile in your hand that's accurate to the nth degree.
So issues around the discovery and preservation of the artefact are incredibly complex, and made all the more complex because of the modern tools we have at our disposal. Now imagine how much more complicated things get when the artefact you're dealing with has never had a physical dimension. Paul Kerbin is our final guest today, and he's the Web Archiving Manager for the National Library of Australia.
If you think of the web, I mean, does it exist as an artefact in itself? I suppose in a sense it does, but it really exists through our interaction with it. It's very much something that exists in the present. You know, you think about how we engage with it. We Google, we tweet, whatever. So it doesn't necessarily leave an artefactual residue. It's really through taking the snapshots of it, taking slices from it, that we actually create the artefactual evidence of the web. Of course, what we create is only a minuscule part of what the web is, because it has that dimension of time. You know, what it was 5 minutes ago is different from what it is as I'm speaking. And then that also then leads us to the question of how do we retain a sense of the context of the artefacts we've got? You know, is it enough to take a snapshot now, and will that give us the context, or do we have to create additional metadata? I mean, to give you an example, we at the National Library, we do an annual snapshot of the Australian web domain. Now, that can take up to about 2 months to run. So what you're looking at isn't any sense of, even if you browse through that snapshot, you're not looking at a snapshot at one point in time. You're looking at a snapshot that can range over a couple of months, for example.
So for somebody like you, that's an enormous power, isn't it? Because you're, in a sense, a curator of what our future understanding of history is going to be.
It is, and this has been a great debating point, an issue amongst people involved in web archiving for the last couple of decades. We took an approach at the National Library, which is a selective approach for a lot of very practical reasons to do that, but it does mean that we have to make decisions about what we will collect and what we won't collect based on our resources, our priorities, technical issues, lots of other factors. But that's always been a concern to a lot of people in the web archiving community, because we are then making these decisions and we don't necessarily know what is going to be of interest to the researchers in the future. So then you get other approaches like the Internet Archive in San Francisco that have tried to constantly crawl the whole internet, the whole web, and try and take a snapshot of collect it all. Of course, they're not collecting it all because you've got this time factor and it's so vast, but they're trying to say, well, you know, we won't make the selection decisions. We'll just send the robots out and crawl it and take a snapshot and let people in the future work out what they want to look at. But yes, we are making those decisions, and no doubt there will be many, many researchers in the future that are disappointed in those decisions because we haven't collected in a particular area in the depth that's required. But it's not just a matter of making the decisions, because the technologies to actually collect the material are limited, so we may have great intention of collecting something, but we just can't do it. There may be legal constraints to what we can do as well.
There are bodies like yours in Australia collecting material, collecting digital material, preserving digital material. In the United States, in the UK, in, I would presume, all Western countries. What about the developing world? If there's not, is that likely to skew our understanding of history in the future?
I think it will. There certainly would not be as much activity in the developing world as there is in first world. I think it's helpful that we do have the Internet Archive, which is, you know, it doesn't discriminate where it travels to collect. It can only do so much, and it's limiting, but at least that does provide a general context for that. But it is an issue for some countries. I mean, what has happened in the last 10 years is there's been a lot more tools developed that are open source, that can be set up relatively simply to capture information. And, you know, in some places, for example, in Egypt, there is a very strong web archiving process going on there. You know, they did some wonderful collecting of the social media around the Arab Spring. Now, again, you know, there are issues of actually making that content accessible, but at least they were established and had a strong web archiving and social media archiving program to at least be able to capture the material. You know, there's always issues of how vulnerable that material may be, you know, whether it will be looked after and not lost. But I think it's getting easier in the sense that you don't have to develop all the tools yourself now, as when we began at the National Library, we really had to do ourselves.
The National Library of Australia's Paul Kerbin. And to put some figures to the task Paul and his colleagues are charged with, across the National Library of Australia's three digital collections, they have 300 terabytes of data comprised of 700 billion files. Try digging through that lot. We also heard today from Maurizio Forte at Duke University, Chantal Knowles at the Queensland Museum, and Benjamin Issakhan at Deakin University. Thanks to Karin Savanovitz, my co-producer, and sound technician Steve Fieldhouse. This is Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell. Cheers.
In the Bodysphere podcast, a doctor who's also kind of an explorer and traveller.
When I was a little boy, I wanted to be a geographer. I was fascinated by maps, and I used to spend a lot of my time dreaming of travelling around the world. There's a lot of similarities, and as a doctor, I do feel as if I'm journeying through the landscape of the body.
Adventures in Human Being, in the Bodysphere with Amanda Smith. Listen online at the RN website.